Space Burgers. I am David Huntsberger. If you're just joining us for the first time, we're tucked safe and sound in a cave deep in the recesses of space. None of the bad things out there or in here. Just all come in, have a comfortable warg, a nice warm hug, and see what's going on in the world. Let's check in with a citizen of planet Earth. Okay, back for part four with Ambrose. The last segment we left off where you were talking about like wanting to make a connection. And first, before I get into that, I do think it's interesting, like for me, like the parallels, me getting into stand-up, being very shy, and it kind of like, it makes it a lot easier to talk to people out in general. Like, well, how bad can this go? I've already talked to like a group of people and I've seen how well that can go. I've also seen how poorly that can go. So anywhere in between is going to be fine. It did like make a difference. And I would imagine similarly with you, like if you can get up and show your skin to a room full of strangers and sort of have like, I guess the term people use is like having men around your finger or whatnot, like it would make it easier out in public, like you say, to transport them into the club in your mind and then deal with them, talk with them that way. So we're kind of similar in that way, I guess. And thinking that if I were in a strip club, I would be so uncomfortable. I don't really like being there. And it's nothing personal to anyone. I find it strange that people seek out and go pay like what those married guys do for like, I've got to see some boobs.
To get dry hum.
Yeah, to get like Brent Weinbach, this comedian, has a series of jokes about like going to a strip club with his buddies and just being like, you guys all want to go get boners together? That'd be great, right? I'll pay for you to get a boner and you. It just seems like the strangest place to go hang out. And I like that level of escapism. And I always just feel odd. And yet, the few times I've been there, I always feel like the girls can tell that, like, that guy seems like a nice enough guy, and then come over toward me, and I don't want to be rude. I'm like, please get away. Please don't go. So I just have the most odd time. So the fact that you reached out and we're chatting now and having a very delightful conversation is really reaffirming just in a humanistic sense, and no two people are ever really that different, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
I thought about you. No, I thought you, like, in the context of a strip club, as you're saying that, I would tell that you're not the kind of person who's super comfortable with it. I can tell. And so what I would do, even if I wanted to talk to you a little bit and to know you, I wouldn't sit directly with you. If you were friends, I would sit, like, between you and your friend. And then kind of maybe say something I thought would spark your interest. And then maybe we would talk, and then maybe, because it'd be kind of like a challenge, like, oh, this guy, he doesn't want any of it. Well, we'll see about that. Like, you know, not that I think it would, but you can tell. You can definitely tell the kind of guys who want to be there and the ones who don't. And also as far as, you know, getting dry humped, yes, that is the main point of a strip club. But a lot of guys and some dancers think that it is also a brothel. And so I've had plenty of guys say, you know, like, I got a condom or are you getting the blowjar or what? And it's like, I don't, and that's why I like to pick, because I can kind of tell, like, who's going to be trifling.
Yeah. And then, from that, like, the thing you mentioned in the last one, I think you, or maybe it was part two, this has been a, for people listening, this has been a month-long endeavor, this conversation, which is, it's moved past a trilogy. The typical route, I guess, through the club would be kind of, it's like being in a candy store to some degree. You know, like, dating's got
to
be hard.
It's like speed dating, you know, you get to the fun part, well, I guess, like, technically the fun part first, where you don't see each other naked, but they see you naked, and it's an intimate situation, you're in a private room. Just to fast forward through all that, and to get to that private first, it gives it, if you were going to have a relationship with a person outside the club that you met, I think it will give it a very different, I don't know, it's just set up differently.
Yeah.
Because you're not just a girl you met out. You're a dancer or a stripper that they met out, and it comes with a whole other thing. So I don't know. I don't know, dating. I'm not sure. I haven't really done it yet.
Well, there's got to be something about being, for especially for a guy who, like, you know, keep going back to men that had a wife that maybe she wears sweats and hangs out around the house and is like, dude, I'm not going to dress up for you every night. We've been together for 20 years. And, but maybe she's kind of has some inhibitions or whatnot, like where, you know, there's something about, whoa, that girl's walking out in front of a room full of people and totally controlling the situation with no clothes. You know, that can be an attractive thing. People can look at that and go, whoa, that is really impressive. I mean, I couldn't do that. No one I know could do that. It's really, like, foreign, I think, to most people. So they're just inherently built into people seeing that and being around it is probably they're instantly attracted to something beyond just your physical form.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that also, I mean, competition is a big part of it because I've met a lot of guys who they don't want to just go straight to the back. They say, I want to meet someone that I like that I can have a conversation with. So it's not just that thing to my naked. And then, yeah, there's a whole thing behind it of, you know, she must be this type of person to be able to do this. But to actually have a connection, I think most of them are looking for a connection. And they are picky. They're just as picky as I can be. They're just as picky about the girls they want to take back and spend money on and spend time with.
And so, all right, that'll make sense. So it is... If you ever do, if we end up chatting in person, I'd be so interesting to hear how being outside of the club and traveling and all these things are affecting, you know, your view on what is civilization, what is humanity, how is it forging relationships with itself and with each other within it, and what's important to you. And, you know, people are seeking all the time, like, the best place to get into what they consider the most beneficial relationship for themselves. So I'm going to go on online dating because I can mathematically find someone who's going to be just right for me. Or I'm going to go into this club where there are going to be people cycling through every night and I can kind of pick and choose. Or I'm going to go to bars. Or I'm going to go to poetry recitals, or on and on. Like, people are... And I think eventually you just find that, like, there are a lot of options out there. And sometimes that might not be the best thing in the world.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. And I know that when I have too many options, I'm paralyzed. I'm paralyzed by the options I have because I don't know which one to pick. And my girlfriend and I, the one who dances with me, we talk about the same thing. Like, even if we're in a room with a nice guy and spending money and it's good money and everything, I'm still thinking in my head, oh, I wonder who else just came in to the club and is on the floor. I'm always looking for the next best thing. It's like chasing a high or something. I don't know what it is. It's always just looking for the next best thing and never being satisfied, even when you have what it is you are trying to accomplish, the time and the money.
Yeah.
It's a very strange thing. I think the same thing would be for dating. I think I would like some things about people that I would see out if I ever did, like, a Tinder or, like, a Blended or something, but I'd always be thinking, oh, well, there's this flaw, so what else is better? What else is perfect? I think that's just how I am right now. It could change, but
yeah,
I think that's how I view the world as well.
Yeah, I mean, when you see people that come from a small town and they're high school sweethearts and they stay married for 50 years, you're like, well,
I don't get that.
Well, but if you think, like, because when you fall in love with somebody, there is a connection there where you're like, the rest of the outside is closed off. Like, we got it. We mm-hmm. found the thing. And so inevitably people are going to have not necessarily little rough edges, but things where you, and it's so dumb, they do it in romantic movies all the time, where those little rough edges become the thing that you're the most attracted to. And if you start off in a small town with the person that you grow to love, and then as you get older, all of those things just add to it. Whereas if you go out into the world with billions of people, legitimately, and you are seeing them, you can see this person. I mean, especially for you, you could look at, like, this person is the right height, the right skin tone, the right teeth, the right amount of money, the right niceness, he's the right dresses the right way, on and on and on. And girls are more picky than guys in that regard, I would say.
Yeah.
Without sounding too sexist or anything like that. And I think that would get tough. Like, because you, like you're saying, you have one bird in hand and then going, wait a second, what if this guy over here is even nicer? That'd be tough.
Yeah, and that's just how I feel about most things, even. Just, like, even where I want to live, you know, just I think it's just how, that's my nature. And so it's, for me, I think dating would be stressful. Well, I mean, I'm not saying I'm going to do it. It will happen eventually, but it will be a very stressful thing. And I will always be looking for the next best thing, which will probably never be.
Don't say that. I hope you never settle. I hope your quest out there.
Never.
Okay, good. Well, thank you so much for spending so much time, and we'll check in down the road because I'd love to hear where this goes, and I hope you have a very successful journey and life.
Thank you. I just like to check in. I'll be in LA for the next couple of weeks, so thank you so much for calling me. I appreciate it. I love it.
Okay, cool. Thanks, Ambrose. We'll talk to you down the road.
Okay, great.
Okay, bye. And Gary, we're rolling on this. Okay, this is probably going to go in chapter 4. I looked down. I didn't have a weapon. He was holding nunchucks. I knew I was in trouble. There's nothing around I could grab and use as any sort of stick or anything like that. Suddenly, I realized I was wearing a ring. I gently tilted it to the side so the jewel was facing out. He didn't know it, but his next breath was going to be his last. Will there be more of the saga of Ambrose? We'll see. Hopefully things are going well. I think I mentioned last time that she's in her final leg of, that's kind of a play on words, I guess, but she's going to retire from the dancing game, and who knows what's next. So we'll try to check in down the road. And if she ever makes a trip out to LA, maybe, or a trip into space, get a sit down in the actual space cave. I'm going to be in Boise, Idaho. I'll probably mention that again at the end as well, as part of the Tree Fort Festival. So if you live in Idaho, come out. I'll be there this week, the 24th through the 28th at Liquid Laughs. Come out and see some stand-up comedy. And there'll be a bunch of locals and people from surrounding regions there doing a little bit of time before I go up. So it should be fun. All right, let's get to our chat with a true genius. It's been real. He'd be frustrated to hear me say that. Apologies. But I do feel like it's really been a bizarre experience to chat with these people that are so intelligent. And there's obviously a humanistic element that maybe you can ignore sometimes in people. We're like, this person, everything's going great for them. They're so smart. Life just comes so easy. And not to say that life is extraordinarily difficult for my guests or any of my guests, but I don't know what it is. There's something about this feeling that we have where people who are so intelligent, they can't relate or can't kind of define or describe the way they see the world. And so far it's been a lot of the opposite. Very, very engaging, very down-to-earth, normal people, and really enjoyable to talk to. And then on top of that, filled with so much cool information about the world. So we sat down and had some Elysium Space Dust from Elysium Brewing. If you haven't had it, try it. It's great. Space Dust. Come on, get into that. And he wanted me to mention ahead of time that the views expressed are his and not those of JPL's from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Here's my chat, part one, with Jason Rabinovich. Right into it. Jason Rabinovich, is that how you say it?
That is correct.
Pretty phonetic. Briefly mentioned that Canada does not export a ton of IPAs. I figured they wouldn't, but when I've been up there, the craft beering? craft brewing.
Beer scene?
Yeah, the beering is definitely happening everywhere, it seems like, where they...
Oh, yeah.
They don't export a ton of it. So we're having this Space Dust from Elysium Brewing. I'd had it before. I thought it was pretty good. I'm drinking mine out of this Brett Kern Signature Space Cave mug. It's the only mug I use to drink beer. Get yours at brettkern.com. Love this mug. It's ancient ceramic. I don't know. It's it's not ancient.
It's blue and shiny.
Yeah, yeah. It looks like a Simpsons figure or something, right?
Yeah, pretty well.
Yeah. What do you think of it after your first sip?
It's nice, actually.
Okay, good. A lot of people are into IPAs. I would consider myself, I guess, a fan of them. I think I like maybe pale ales more than just the India pale ale. I think I can kind of tell the difference a little bit. Mostly it's just the hoppiness.
This one isn't too hoppy, though. It's okay. Pretty full, yeah.
See, by liking IPAs, is it a recent thing? Is it kind of like because they became more prevalent?
I used to hate them originally when I first started drinking beer and was more into pale ale and stuff like that. But over the past 5-6 years, I've really come to like them. So,
oh, cool. Yeah, is it just the hoppiness? What is I'm curious. Where so a few, you're probably the third person now on the show who's specified, and not like you were. I'm not coming unless we drink IPAs. But you know, some people just go, oh, I don't care anything that's beer, and then so I'll try to pick something that's maybe from where they're from or has something to do with them. But when you said like I like IPAs, I'm curious like what draws people to it.
I don't know. I find them almost refreshing at some point, and with the hoppy flavor, just really enjoyable to drink and relaxing, and
mm-hmm.
and you drink it with food too. I mean, I'm not that picky. I would have drunk anything that you put in front of me, anyways.
Oh, good. Good to know.
But this is a nice surprise.
Nice. Waiting for that first guest that shows up and goes, "Nope, not today," and just heads on.
Just turns around and leaves.
Yeah. Yeah. And if they had to like ride a bike or something to get here, and they really, I mean, it would really be just so insulting. They wouldn't even take a chance to take some free beer and just a rest from the bicycling. So you and I have never met. This is our first meeting.
First meeting.
Yeah, I feel it feels kind of like a blind date, which I enjoy. I like that.
So we swiped right on the podcast.
We both agreed. Hey, I like this, the cut of this guy's jib. Just the look of his, I hadn't even seen your face. Like you, I guess, got through our mutual friend, Jake Markovitz,
exactly.
Got kind of pitched on the idea. And he brought you up to me by saying, oh, I think like you live near him or something like that.
Yeah, we live like one block away from each other.
Okay.
Right now.
Yeah. And that's how you know each other, just living near each other?
I actually met him through his girlfriend.
I went on
Birthright with his girlfriend.
Birthright,
the free trip to Israel.
Oh, cool, nice. Oh, okay. I should know what that is. I've heard Birthright before. Okay, so you—that's when you what turn a certain age, or you can go.
It's before you turn 26 usually, and then if you're, you know, kind of like a quarter Jewish, you can go explore the country and learn a little more about Judaism, heritage, Israel in general.
Whoa, that's amazing. What age were each of you when you went?
I think I waited till I was 26, so I did it at the very last possible moment, of course.
And working at JPL, I would assume you're not like really, really devoutly religious, and I could be completely wrong, but just...
I'm an atheist. Okay. I consider myself culturally Jewish, but I'm always surprised. I actually find that there are a lot more religious scientists than you would expect originally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I prefer to always think of it that way, that it's annoying when people go, oh, science, atheist. Like, no, that's, they don't...
Not necessarily, yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people who find very interesting ways to kind of make their religious views and their scientific views match and work together.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really interesting to talk about.
I went through a phase where I really thought they should be exclusive. And it was only because I had this professor in college who I hated, who gave me a D that I didn't earn. Like, I'll take a D if I really slacked off. I worked really hard. I showed my work. I'd be off like in the 10,000th place on some sort of titration thing, or I don't know, some sort of like iteration of a fluids problem or something. And he would give me no credit, just wrong, just fully wrong. And I remember standing outside of his office one day, and he was on the phone with someone, and he said, "All right, well, I gotta get going. May the Lord bless you with a wonderful day." And I was like, I hate this guy. I just thoroughly hated him. Just, I have no reason, but it was always odd to me that he was that religious, that he was bringing it into just standard conversation, daily
right.
stuff.
Yeah. That, I think it's, you don't see that as much anymore these days.
That's good. Hope that guy toned it down a bit. Not to say that you shouldn't be saying, or you can't say that this, but what if the guy on the other end wasn't religious at all? You don't want to be hearing that.
Right, so.
Yeah, anyway. So you mostly, and I'm assuming by age 26 you'd made up your mind, like, this is how I feel about religion. However, I've procrastinated enough. It's do or don't do, and I want to see Israel for free.
Exactly. And just to, I mean, there's still a lot of cultural stuff that I'd, you know, like to learn more about and be in touch with. So it was great to see Israel, and it has such a rich history, and it's a really beautiful country. So that part of the trip was pretty awesome.
And do you get to see, you know, the outlands and not necessarily like just rural areas, but you see like a more than just here's a religious place, here's a religious place?
Oh yeah, yeah. You get to see from major cities to some small areas. I mean, they keep you away from some of the borders, so they try to keep it as safe as possible.
Yeah, that's probably smart.
With a busload of American, and though I was a token Canadian on that trip, which mm-hmm. is interesting too. Me and a bunch of New Jersey, New York people.
Yeah,
that was fun. Yeah, but yeah, they show you a lot of different sites, and you get a nice variety, which is a lot of fun.
I saw this, I was eating and like a patio sort of cafe place a while ago, and this caravan sort of older, very traditionally, like, I think they were Hasidic Jews. One guy had like the dreadlocks, not just, they weren't just curly, they were like full, almost like hippie-ish looking dreadlocks. And he got out, he was the oldest of them. He was wearing just a black robe that was kind of tied up. It looked religious, but it was also, he just had like sandals on, this robe, a cool hat, and the beard and the locks. And then he was smoking a cigarette, and he just walked into the place in California just with a lit cigarette, shuffled in. And I was so curious. Like, I wanted to follow him. And if people just go, hey, you can't smoke. Oh, you're very religious. Yeah, do what you like.
Go for it.
And then I thought, I mean, that seemed, not to get into religion in their odd, you know, but no pork, but you can smoke cigarettes. And that seemed odd. And
yeah, there's a lot of the ways some religious people interpret, yeah, the old rules and stuff like that. It's really interesting. It's kind of just a game of how can you find a loophole here and do what you really want to do and stuff like that. But yeah, we don't have to go down that road.
Okay. All right. We'll steer away from that, because the bigger reason, I guess, or before I do, when you were there, when you were in Israel looking around, did the cultural aspect of it, did it make you closer to the religious part of it as well and feel like, oh, I want to stay in touch with this throughout my life?
So I didn't think it actually made me closer to the religious aspect, in all honesty. It made me appreciate the culture and like how, you know, people are a little more relaxed on the day-to-day going out. And you also really do respect the maturity because there's a mandatory military service and they live in such a dangerous area. So that was really interesting. But to me, it actually didn't bring me, you know, closer to God, so to speak, in a stereotypical manner or anything like that.
But so most of my Jewish friends maintain a level of like, yeah, I'll put out a menorah, or I'll observe some of the Seders or Passover, you know, like a few things stay, and they're just like, ah, come on, I got it. Do you that?
Yeah, no, I'm that weird, you know, person who like usually doesn't eat pork, but if I'm at someone's house and their parents are going to make dinner, of course I'm going to eat pork. I'm not going to make them cook something else, and I'll still light candles for a menorah, and I'll try to keep Passover if I don't forget and eat a bagel on the first day, and all that weird mismatch of everything that doesn't really make sense.
Yeah, but I love it, though. I think, you know, I grew up with Christmas. It doesn't on any level make sense to me from a religious standpoint. However, I like a reason to get together and be nice to each other, see each other. I mean, those are
a lot of it's just family too. Mm-hmm. I associate Passover with a big family gathering and a great dinner and stuff like that, and actually seeing cousins who I haven't seen for a while. So
nice. And what part of Canada are you from? Toronto?
I'm from Toronto originally.
Okay, and so that's how Jake sort of pitched you, like, oh, my neighbor is a Canadian, and he works at JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and that to me seemed like Valhalla or something. It seems like you guys are. I just read The Martian, and so that has, they didn't do anything to change my perception of what goes on there. Just a bunch of really smart people. I guess you're probably not always working on some crunch deadline, like, we gotta get this up in the sky.
Yeah, no, I mean, most things generally take a lot longer in the space industry than what happened in The Martian.
You don't crank stuff out in 60 days?
I don't think we've ever built an entire spacecraft in 60 days. I'm very confident in saying we've never done that. I mean, there are deadlines, and there's lots of stuff we do where people are working around the clock to get stuff done. But the scope of the work and these big, you know, robotic exploration missions and stuff we do, I mean, that's years and years and years. It's not something you can just kind of pick up, work 24 hours a day, and be done in 60 days.
Yeah. No matter, there's always that one person who's, and that, this is final. Then everyone kind of bands together, damn it, I guess I'm going to be eating inside tonight.
Yeah, but I mean, that happens all the time too. I mean,
people do get deadlines like that where you do eat in the office and don't go home.
I don't want to sleep there. I've never slept in my office before, but I mean, there's definitely days when I've left lab at 1 or 2 in the morning and then come back at 7 or 8 the next morning. So,
wow. So it's a dedication out of like necessity, out of you're all on a team, like we got to get this done, or is it, you're getting paid overtime, might as well take advantage.
We don't really get too much overtime. So it's, most people who go to work in this industry aren't doing it for the money. It's a really cool project. You have a deadline, you know. It's very easy to kind of, in my mind, justify, well, I'm not really going to sleep much tonight, but I'm working on trying to get a helicopter to fly on Mars, which is a really awesome idea and would be so cool if that worked. So you know, I'm going to put in the hours in, and I don't want the helicopter to crash. I don't want it to break. So,
yeah, I've always really loved that aspect of the best and brightest. It, like open source software where people just kind of want to show off, like, look what I made. Here, you can have it. Look, isn't that cool? Like, and I don't think there's a narcissism behind it. I think there's a genuine, like, I like making it and I like sharing it.
And sharing it, people take pride in their work. And also, I mean, anything open source is great too, because then you get feedback and people find all your mistakes.
That's it. And so is there kind of a, what's the breakdown in the JPL of, say, like men to women?
It's getting better. That's the first thing I'll say. I mean, it's definitely not 50-50 yet.
Mm-hmm. But does it feel like a boys' club? A lot of high-fiving and betting and kind of puffing chests out, and we'll see who solves that.
I mean, it's going to depend who you ask. I'm a white male, so I'm kind of lucky in that respect that there's no sexism directed against me, usually. Mm-hmm. From the, you know, I'd like to think it's not as bad as it used to be. There's definitely, unfortunately, a little bit of an aspect like that in terms, especially if you look at the more senior and older employees where it was more of a male-dominated kind of culture. But looking at the new hires, it's getting closer to kind of the 50-50 breakdown, which is really nice to see.
Mm-hmm.
And then especially working amongst younger coworkers, I mean, I don't experience anything like that. And it's always a mixed audience. It's always guys and girls. And
yeah. I like when you see a photograph of like the CERN facility or some exploration off of Antarctica, and you see a group gathered together that is there for one reason, and that's just an enthusiasm about research and science.
Exactly.
And they're broken up not just by sex, but by age and race, and it's a really, and you know, I don't think it always has to be like a Bud Light commercial where like, wow, how convenient that one of every group is there. But I do think it's cool to see that in a genuine setting, like, whoa, these people all got brought together because like they want to fly a helicopter on Mars. I think compared to, say, when we think of men smoking in Houston and talking
yeah,
about.
it's changed from there. I mean, I did actually work at CERN for a summer too, which
Whoa.
Is great. And there actually, it was that environment. I was a summer student there, so of course it's mixed people as well. But it was really interesting to see all the different cultures come together, all to work on the accelerator and to study particle physics, but also to kind of show off their culture. So amongst the summer students, we would have different parties. So like the Italians would throw a party 1 month, and then the Belgians would throw a party in the Netherlands and stuff like that. So you, and everyone would take pride in cooking some food from their home country and like having drinks representative of what they would drink at home. So it was really interesting.
Oh, that's amazing. I didn't see the whole thing. I saw a good portion of a documentary about the culture in Antarctica, and they did stuff like that as well there. Like the people who stay for the winter, which is a long period, and everyone else kind of flies off. They take, and everyone is just standing there like,
see you later.
And it seems so horrifying. Like, what have I done with my life? And yet they all end up kind of growing to like it because that camaraderie, like that, you know, community they build there is really solid. You know, you have to like lean on each other.
Right. And you can't really go outside either. So,
yeah. So I want to know more about JPL, and then I definitely want to hear about your time at CERN, but I'm really curious, like, how you ended up there. Like, little kid from Toronto, what like, drove you toward it or pulled you toward science and rockets, and what is your background exactly, like, your degree?
So I grew up in Toronto, was, you know, standard Canadian kid growing up, played hockey seriously, wanted to be a professional hockey player from a very young age,
mm-hmm.
quickly burned out of that and like
started. How quickly?
I was playing AAA until like 10 or 11 and then had some super serious coaches. Like I remember one of my coach getting jumped by opposing team players at the end of a game when we were 10. So this is parents just getting into it, and like he would throw water bottles at the refs and stuff like that. So just bizarre scene.
I just watched that Simpsons episode where Bart is playing Hockey Dad, the video game.
Yeah.
And he pummels the guy to death, and then and the music starts, burr, 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 and then the video game goes as the cops are hauling away, you're a man, you're a real man.
Luckily, it wasn't so bad. No cops ever had to show up.
Oh, okay. But there were genuine fights.
So, and then, you know, things calmed down. I always was into sports growing up and still, I mean, I play on the JPL hockey team right now.
Man, that's cool.
Yeah, it's awesome. But was kind of always just interested in space, interested in engineering, building things, looking up at the stars. I mean, I never really knew what it... I knew I was interested in space. I never really knew what it meant to work in the space industry for a very long time.
Can I interrupt for just a second? What month were you born?
June.
Did you read... Was it David and Goliath, the Malcolm Gladwell one about the... or is it Outliers?
That one's Outliers.
So did that burn a little bit? Like, ah, damn it.
Not born in January. Can't play hockey. No, that one... I mean, I've... Yeah, no. I was never at that point. I was never going to make it.
So, okay.
I mean, one kid I played with plays in the NHL, but...
Nice.
That's... Yeah. Canadians.
Do you stay in touch?
No. I haven't seen him since I was probably 10.
As good as any time to reach out.
Hey, man.
Remember
some tickets. But yeah, growing up, just interested in space, studied math, physics, chemistry in high school, stuff like that. I knew I wanted to go into engineering, kind of. I liked science. I also liked a little more applied and building stuff. Ended up in undergrad studying mechanical engineering.
See, because when you say space, and I think that's when someone does end up in a place where you work, I think of like October sky or things like that, where a kid is just like always looking up in the sky, and his life is just, how can I get there? How can I get up into space? And then they say, well, there's this program in school. I'll do it. And it sounds like you were interested.
I was interested, but I was a little more like, you know, if you read some of the astronaut stories and Chris Hadfield and people like that who knew from, you know, age 8 or 9, like, I want to be an astronaut. And then they just researched everything they needed to do and they did that. And it's super impressive. I was a little more roundabout. Like, I was interested in math and science. I liked studying those subjects. I ended up being, you know, I could hold my own in those subjects. And then I just kind of went along that path. Studied engineering in undergrad. I mean, I was also one of those ones, I was never super intent on getting internships or doing research in first year university. I worked at a summer camp for most of my life. I was a camp counselor. And, like, was used to spending my summers outside, being ridiculous, being a counselor for, like, 12-year-old kids. Mm-hmm. Even younger sometimes, but...
And this is something you did through high school?
Through high school and after freshman and sophomore year summers too, I was a camp counselor.
Oh, okay.
And then junior year summer was a summer where I was like, all right, I'm liking engineering more, I like science, I want to keep doing this, like, I should probably get a real internship or something, like...
Yeah.
Or someone asked me on my resume, they're like, and how old were you at summer camp? So, I mean,
I was really good at it. It was the best.
I had fun doing it. But that's how I ended up at CERN. Junior year summer, I was talking to my friends, and one of my friends had done the program before, an Italian. And I applied, didn't hear anything back, just assumed I was not accepted. And then a few weeks or months later, basically, my application had been forwarded to the Canadian Institute for Particle Physics. And I got an email out of the blue from a prof from U of T saying, if you're still interested, we can fund you to go to CERN for the summer.
Wow.
And, like, pay for your flights, give you a living stipend and stuff like that.
And this is just kind of, at that point, an out of the blue email for you.
Yeah, I was like, well, I'm going back to camp this summer. Like, I've got nothing else lined up.
Bing! Oh, a new email. I hope that's about summer camp.
Oh, free trip to Switzerland.
There's such a definitive, like... delineation there between, like, childhood and adulthood, kind of like, oh, you're gonna go ahead and this summer you're going into being a grown-up.
Yeah, but then there were all the summer student parties and we got to travel around Europe. Yeah. Okay. Which was awesome. I mean, it was a really nice program. We got to attend lectures in the morning and learned a lot about cosmology and astronomy and some of the fundamental particle physics they were actually doing there, because as an engineer, a lot of that stuff is just way over my head.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I studied civil engineering, and I think we're kind of similar in that, like, there were things I entertained as a younger person, like, oh, maybe I could do that. And then you do kind of settle in and go, oh, I need to really focus on this. But for me, it was never like education and like, oh, I gotta get on track with this education to get to this place or this career. But when you do, like, I took physics as part of engineering, but it just didn't seem like it synced up so much with when you get into astronomy and...
Yeah, I mean, especially the cosmology stuff. Like, you know, going through engineering, you deal with problem sets and equations, and then they'd put some of those equations on the board, and you're just like, oh my God. Like, that is the, like, 4 lines long. You're like, I have no idea what's going on right
now. Yeah.
Because I was just working on some of the magnets. I was, as an engineer, you know, making sure the beam...
Were your grades really good? Had you taken some electives that showed them you had an interest that might suit that sort of...
I was doing fine. I mean, honestly, this is also one of those lucky situations. I was a Canadian at an American school, and it was government funding, so it was a weird loophole that because I was at an American school, I wasn't eligible for other funding, so it was easier for them to fund me. And weird. I was kind of the, you know, first person in this pilot program. And it's been going on since, which is awesome.
What school were you at?
I was at Yale.
Okay, so you're I always know when people did some graduate work or a PhD or thing, because they say undergrad and everyone else goes, when I was in college. So you did undergrad there, and then that obviously helped. Like that sort of institution, Absolutely. They said, well, just a mechanical engineer at Yale is going to have maybe a better chance of grasping this and moving forward than, say, a...
Yes and no sometimes. So... That helped, and then I came to Caltech for my graduate work. But one of the first years at Caltech, we were at an emeritus prof's house, and he was just talking to us, and you know, he asked me, like, Jason, where did you go to undergrad? I went to Yale. He's like, why'd you go there? They have a horrible engineering program. I'm like, it's not horrible. It's just small. I actually really enjoyed it and think it's a great program. But he's used to, you know, seeing people coming from MIT and Stanford and stuff like that.
Oh, I see. So it's just, that is weird, because, like, I went to Colorado State, and it's, you know, it's got a well-respected engineering program, but... That's funny that there would be like a clout that isn't associated with Yale. Like,
oh yeah, it's like
Yale engineering.
What comes out of there?
So, but sorry. I sort of asked the question. You were sort of answering it, but I think I jumped in a little bit as far as like what made you an ideal candidate as opposed to say a grad student from somewhere else or.
I think it was so they had engineering opportunities as well. So. Just my background there kind of fit in, and I think it was kind of GPA and then being all rounded. I was on the sailing team at college and stuff like that. And then
Yale sailing.
Yeah, no, it can't really doesn't get worse than that.
As a hockey man, it doesn't seem like you would gravitate toward Yale sailing.
I was playing intramural hockey too while there, which was awesome.
Was sailing fun? Does it get a bad rap, or was it a lot of?
It was a ton of fun.
Toss me that line, sport.
Yeah, no,
there's none of that.
It's not like that for college sailing.
So. Okay, cool.
Yeah, no, it was a lot.
I don't know why I said cool. Okay, good. Okay. It's fine if you say sport. I kind of actually root for it to still be throw me that sport.
Yeah.
But no. So I've had people on the show who've, you know, attended those universities where it's frustrating to be like, yeah, all right, yeah, I went to this school. I'm still a normal human being. It's got to be a little bit bothersome when everyone always has these expectations or assumptions.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I'm old enough now that, you know, undergrad was several years ago, that it's not held against you in any way, shape, or form. I mean, I loved my time there. I was actually really impressed by the people. It was the thing that I liked the most, just meeting really interesting and really smart people.
Mm-hmm.
But I, you know, there's always the occasional person who's really quick to judge when you say you went to a school like that. But
sure.
99% of the people I meet, they're just like, all right.
I think that's so great, too, that you got to, like, you could almost have a chip on your shoulder of like, I know I only went to Yale engineering, but I'm going to do my best for you guys.
It was interesting, though, because I came out to Caltech for a one-year master's program, and people from all sorts of schools. So, you know, little schools in the middle of nowhere to MIT, Stanford, to the big engineering schools. And it was really interesting to see. Everyone had a different background. Everyone had their strengths and weaknesses. You kind of learned really quickly. For us, you know, when we needed math help, we went to the French people. When we needed solids help, we went to the Spaniards and stuff like that. And so, you know, my friends and I could hold our own in fluid mechanics. And it would just kind of circle around. It was a tough enough year that you're just like, does anyone know how to do this problem? Like, we don't care who. Like, please, we need help.
So is that kind of what it is? I really like that about just engineering in undergrad, as I call it, where... You just get turned loose. All right, here's your problem. You've got like 2 weeks if you want to figure this all out. We want this whole presentation done at the end of this, and you're kind of on your own. We'd be sometimes calling businesses and asking them prices or things, or, you know, really getting a feel for like, well, this is how we would make this. And when you're at CERN, what are you working on? And then how loose is it where they're like, yeah, figure this out. Go wherever you need to go. Talk to whoever you need to talk to, but figure it out.
Well, I'll talk to CERN about CERN and JPL for that one, because it's an interesting question. CERN, you know, they did a good job of defining projects for the summer students that you could do independently. For me, we were looking at kind of one of the connections between the magnets that, long story short, if the electrical resistivity was too high, they would overheat. and then the magnets would go above their Curie temperature, which basically means the magnets are no longer magnets. And then
what do they turn into? Just molten?
They're just metal. I mean, it's not that hot. They're not melting. They just lose their magnetic properties.
I didn't realize that could happen.
Yeah, for solid magnets, yeah. And then the problem with that is then you have the beam, which is a beam of protons in this case, that would hit the wall and stuff like that, which is really bad.
And you're trying to, because they're flying nearly at the speed of light. They're zooming through.
So this is before they would get to the LHC. So before they get to that big loop, it's one of the kicker magnets that injects them in there.
So can you back up to give a visual to those people who might not understand how, before you get to the Large Hadron Collider and you've got these kickers, where do they start? Is it a little gun type thing and they're like pew, shooting protons? Or
I'm probably going to say something that's wrong because no I way. Forget. So my certain friends will kill me. But there's a few smaller loops, basically. So they start from a source, and I can't describe the source because I completely forget what it is.
Is it magic?
It's physics.
Ah, dang it. There's
black bots, magic. So we have a magic source that starts
perfect.
The beam.
Okay. No one's going to question that.
Exactly. Magic.
Take it easy, you CERN jerks.
And then they basically accelerate the particles in a few smaller loops and then transfer them to an intermediate one, accelerate, and then transfer it to the LHC. So that
they really get them humming.
And then they get humming really fast. And then, you know, because particle physics is so advanced, you essentially just smash these protons into each other and see what comes out.
And so does that mean you have the spiral going one way, you send them off, and then you have it the other way and you send them in the other direction?
So there's two paths in the LHC with particles going one way and particles going the other way. And then the scientists have them intentionally collide where they have detectors to measure what the head comes
out. Okay, I see. So you've got them moving, and they have to be headed in a different direction. It's not two different setups, though, of these coils, or is it?
I actually forget. I think it depends. I think you get the change in direction when they're injected into the LHC.
That's got to be fun for everyone when they look and see, all right, the speeds on the left side and the right side are equal. Let them loose.
Let's see if they hit each other.
Let them at each other. And then so if it's off by a nanometer, how far does if your magnet doesn't work and the course gets bent a little bit?
So it's more, I mean, it's more on the order of centimeters. That's bad because the tube's about, yeah, a few times bigger than, say, a ping pong ball or something like that. So you do have some space. And there's a spread. The beam isn't, you know, extremely tight. It has a finite width and stuff like that.
And they're protons of what? Is there a specific element they use?
Or? Well, they're just loose protons, basically. Okay. And then if I remembered what the magic source was, I would tell you where those protons come from.
I see.
But okay. It's either hydrogen or helium, probably, or something like that.
That's in an odd way, kind of refreshing that you don't know the entire process, because it seems so baffling, and it seems like only something that can only be done if every part, every component, like, hey, you guys are the magnet guys, just focus on that.
Oh yeah, a lot of people focus on their small subcomponent and stuff like that. I mean, also this was a long time ago, but
but still, I mean, how long ago? 5 years?
It was 2007.
So. Oh, okay, so nearly a decade ago, but. Has that much changed? I mean, so Higgs boson was 4 or 5 years after that?
Higgs was, after that. I was still there before the LHC went up to... it was still being basically modified to reach the higher energy levels. So that's what we were working on.
And now that's easy for them. Now they can just flip a switch and, they'll go.
Sure, easy. I mean, it's still amazing. It's you know, called the most complicated machine in the world. And you'd be talking to people who work on, say, some of the detectors. And they'd be like, well, it's not working. Let's turn it off and on again and see if that helps the problem.
They would really say stuff like that?
Oh, absolutely.
Would they be smoking?
They weren't smoking when they said that.
Are there a lot of those guys in these places? The disheveled kind of, give me a minute. Well, you know.
You get your fair share. Like, it also depends on kind of what people's roles are. So right now at JPL, you know, a lot of those guys you'll see smoking outside are all the flight technicians, who are the ones who actually build the spacecraft and assemble everything together.
Oh, okay.
And so, you know, when they want their smoke break, they'll go out and take their smoke break, and then they'll come back, and you'll just sit there and wait for them.
Do you guys crush them at hockey?
So it's hot. We don't play internal JPL at hockey. It's just a regular adult league in Pasadena. So.
Oh, okay. So did you guys succeed in your magnets?
My project, I mean, it was one of those, you know, little small things where, like, here's my recommended solution. We'll see what you guys do.
Did they use it?
They used parts of it in the end. They had to change some other things, too. But
that's got to be a good feeling, though. I mean, for you, that it's a project and I'm a student, I'm just here having fun. But also, like, this is a thing that is trying to, in a sense, recreate the beginning of all time to a certain degree. not exactly that, but what they are doing.
Oh, it's super interesting. Just fundamental physics and trying to have a better understanding of our universe and how things interact with each other, which is a crazy question.
I did a little joke about a little joke. Who am I? My aunt? Do one of your little skits. I don't have an aunt that says that, but I had a bit about, like, there was some fear initially that the racing these protons towards each other could, and I don't remember, it had something to do with matter and antimatter,
creating mini black holes.
Mini black holes, yeah. And so what level of, like, fear of anything on that magnitude did people at that facility have?
Zero.
Absolute zero.
Just like, yeah, just the math doesn't back that up, that anything like that would happen.
Okay. So what were their fears? Just that you're not going to get it done, or that
there are lots of fears about it not working. About, I guess, even if it did work, are we going to discover everything? We're putting so much money and time into this. You know, there's no guarantee that our predictions are actually right, and we're going to be able to measure it. And then it's a dangerous facility too, because you have a lot of energy going into the beam, and if something happens, it's a very highly radioactive kind of thing you're shooting around. So there's lots of emergency contingencies if you need to dump the beam, if it's not doing what you want to. There's lots of concerns like that.
So I guess to give like a practical application to it, which is going to be wildly incorrect, but I am curious if you could like give some guidance to it. In my mind, it's kind of like magic at the black box, the little coils, and then you guys are kind of like watching the everlasting gobstopper be made. You run over here, now it's speeding up, and you race a little further and you watch it over here, and then there's like maybe a flash of light, and then you look to a graph and you see that the math lined up and the trajectory it took syncs up with where the math said it would be, and everyone high fives and goes, it happened! The particle moved like we thought it would!
So it actually used to be like that. If you look at some of the...
Exactly like that.
All stages. High fives right after you discover the new particle. It used to be like that in kind of when we were still discovering some of the new fundamental particles. You could actually see them in these bubble experiments and see the trajectories. Now it's, unfortunately, it's a lot less setsy like that. There's really no high-fiving immediately. It's a lot of statistical science. So it's running millions upon millions upon billions of experiments and then looking at the outputs and seeing some of these events they're trying to catch are so rare. So there's a little blip in a graph if you average it over a huge amount of experiments. So it takes a lot of data analysis and post-processing. And then you're really not sure if it's right. Then you wait a little longer. Then you see if someone else can verify, you know, what you've done.
So like hearing that and that you're a part of it. You're kind of like, not that you're closed in with blinders to a certain degree, but your head's down, you're working on your thing. The overall big picture of that, if you were, say there's a mastermind somewhere going, build me a facility and race protons, what are we trying to do? What are we trying to learn? What are we trying to achieve by that?
By the whole CERN facility
in general? The whole CERN facility, yeah. So I mean, the Higgs boson, I would say, is a success.
I mean, at the higher level, it's really just a fundamental understanding of how our universe works and how it behaves with each other. And, you know, why the Higgs boson, which is trying to answer the question, like, how do we really have mass? I mean, we know about gravity, but, like, what really explains that? And mm-hmm. So it's learning all of these different things about all of these different particles that exist, how they interact. Basically, just it really allows us to understand the world we live in. And
okay.
And then there's always a ton of spin-off technologies that have a more, you know, applied practical effect. Because of all this kind of stuff, be it in the medical industry or a few others.
But. Okay, so there are going to be byproducts from it. And if we achieved like atomic computing, supercomputing to a level where like we could process, like you said, millions and billions of the simulations or the equations, would it just advance what we're learning and the byproducts that spin off of them?
Well, I'd almost say that. I mean, like places like CERN are going to actually feedback and help you with things like quantum computing, because CERN is giving you the fundamental knowledge. And then, you know, quantum computing is trying to take advantage of those fundamental interactions and how atoms and matter actually behave and use that to our advantage to higher computing powers and stuff like that. And then you can apply that computing to tons of complicated problems that we can't solve right now.
But we will. That feeling of being there with all those people who just like solving stuff, who, like you as a kid, looked at the sky and said, what is this? And not necessarily in an existential way. You're a kid. You're not like, why are we here? What does this mean? Why am I looking at my hand? Is this a part of me or do I control it? It's not that. It's just you going, cool,
it's cool. And then it's, as you said, it's a lot of asking the question why and how, and like, how does that work? Why is this happening? Like, mm-hmm. is that right? Should it be going like that?
If you, so how, I mean, I can't believe you had an experience at CERN. I feel like that's a pretty limited thing. And, but I guess within the field you're in, you'd go, there were a lot of people there from all over the world. However, comparatively,
right,
pretty limited group. Do you, what are your thoughts? I mean, I guess there's so many thoughts or questions there as far as just existential things with the world and life. And, but if you were to explain what you think just based on research, on math, on physics, the Big Bang, is it just infinite white space and nothingness, no mass, no radiation, no dark energy, and just two things with a little bit of mass moving real fast that hit each other, and then all this came from it? Or what, if you had to guess, what would you...
Yeah, see, that's where I just have no idea. That's where, like, I draw the line where I'm like, I know I don't understand enough of physics to even give a, you know, a rational answer to that.
Isn't that, I mean, that is so strange to me in a good way that you are more qualified, more educated to weigh in on that, surrounded by the people who publish the articles that say, here's a theory on how the universe was created. But to, I mean, you see people at every level on television shows, AM radio, where we came from this, science proves it. And we really don't know, right?
But I think it's okay to say that. Like, we don't know, and that's fine. That's more motivation to do better science, to do more experiments, to do more theory, and try and understand, you know, can we say, like, yes, we actually do know now. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's a lot of what drives me. You know, I've learned... The more I go to school, the more I went to school, the more I realize I don't know very much, and there's so many unanswered questions out there, which I think is great and really interesting. But I also think it's very okay, even in a professional setting, to say I don't know. And
yeah.
I'd rather say that than say something wrong.
Man, I love that. I really think that is refreshing. And to me, that seems to be like the best approach, and the whole reason why science is fun. And like, we don't know, so we're trying to know. And, but people do kind of lock in. I always go back to it because it seems boring to me. The idea that you as a human, it was of course the Big Bang, and then stuff spinning around in space that coalesced, and then a moon started orbiting around it, and then conditions were right, and then bacteria, and then tetrapods, and then evolution on and on, and here we are. And that, it was just an accident, and then when you die, it'll be blackness and nothing, and that's life. There's enough there to kind of go on and be like, there's a really good chance that's what happened. But there's also so much missing, so many gaps, things.
We're pretty sure that's the event that happened, but what triggered what? And as you said, like, what was the Big Bang? Exactly what was it? Why are we in a universe of matter and not antimatter? Because mm-hmm. of a slight asymmetry or what? And all these questions that they're really great and interesting questions. And it's like, well, we might have just gotten really lucky at the end of the day.
When you guys sit around at JPL or at CERN, and you've got the Italians over there, and you've got every other group kind of, do you all look at each other and see human eyes in the same sort of level of questioning and have these conversations? And that must be, I mean, that's an experience I've never had of people from around the world drawn to one place. Do you have those conversations? Like, how do you think we got here?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it ranges from everything. And those, I really love the environments I've been able to live and work in, where you get so many international people and people from different backgrounds. But, I mean, it'll range from everything. It'll range from a conversation about sports, and then it'll range to a conversation about fundamental physics or this and that, and then to something completely different. But yeah, I mean, everyone, you know, at the places I've worked where everyone's a science or an engineer or something like, everyone's happy to have those conversations. And then, you know, it's always fun too with the language barriers and stuff like that to see how people are trying to kind of, you know, explain their thoughts, and that you can tell they could do it so much better in their native language, but they're trying to do it in something else. And I mean, I'm the same way when I speak in French or stuff like that, mm-hmm. where like, I know I sound like I'm in grade 5 or something explaining science, and you're like,
yeah.
Oh, I could do so much better in English.
My Spanish is passable, but it's so rusty. And I was just the other day speaking it, and I just give up halfway through. Like, I'll be speaking, and then el otro, and then I just go walk down the street. Give up. You know what that part means, right? The rest of it was Spanish, but then I just coasted in. And that's got to be tough when you're trying to describe the universe or what you think,
or even just like small basic things. Like when I I spent a year in Paris, and then was working at the French aerospace lab at Honora over there. And I'd be talking to one of my technicians, and in French, I'd be saying, you know, I need the thing to turn the other thing and tighten it. He's like, oh, the screwdriver. I'm like, yes, the screwdriver.
He has like 40 words to get around.
Yeah, and he'd just like give it to me, then like buy me a coffee and be like shaking his head.
That, I mean, there's something romantic about, you know, we think like Da Vinci or Newton or these people like could speak languages, and they wrote and they drew and they poured their minds out. But I don't want to say caliber, but that like type of human being still exists, where I'm looking through a telescope and I'm jotting down what I see, and I can fundamentally understand it and relate it to people and converse with you in Greek or Latin or French. And
I don't know. So I'm a little biased on that stuff too. So I lived in Paris for a year.
Who are you, man?
I've been really lucky.
It's incredible.
Well, we got an email my first year at Caltech saying, you know, we have an exchange program with the École Polytechnique in Paris. It's just outside Paris. If you want to go there for a year, let us know. And
wow.
So obviously went. But I still feel like you meet those kind of, you know, in the Renaissance people, so to speak. And it's a little more prevalent, I found, at least in some European cultures, where I was playing on a random kind of sports team over there, and our captain was a Swiss guy who was a professor at Polytechnique in basically applied physics,
mm-hmm.
Could speak about 6 or 7 languages, was one of the best athletes on the team, and could just do everything.
Yeah.
I can't do anything in comparison to you.
Yeah, it's like when you have an alpha male or a high school bully who you just want to introduce him to that person. Like, right. Look at this guy.
And the nicest person, too,
exactly.
On top of all things.
You see what a jerk you are? This guy has all the reasons to be, and he's not. That would be so nice to be able to do that.
Yeah.
Is it intimidating? I know a lot of people, like, when speaking about intelligence, I got a mechanical engineering degree. I studied at Yale. I went to CERN. But people are all people. They're all the same. They're all equally intelligent. I think being able to be in those situations where you're hearing people talk about the universe and space and just being able to understand it really is a level of intelligence that a lot of people don't have. I would consider myself among them. Like, I would just be standing there going, what are you guys saying?
Oh, I think you'd be fine.
Oh, thanks. I don't know. Maybe everyone is kind of leaning in, and because we don't know, you can always, okay.
We're also like normal people as well, right? We don't always talk shop, and mm-hmm. you can have these kind of more theoretical discussions and without bringing science into it and just talking about opinions and beliefs and things like that.
Okay. For some reason, I just always assume people in that position speak in like equations.
When we have lunch, no words, just Greek letters.
Yeah, that
I mean, you might be disappointed to know most of our lunchtime conversations are fantasy football.
Oh, really? That's reassuring. I think that's good for people. Like, you seem like wizards off in some remote clandestine place building the things that, like, you probably have alien ships there and access to that sort of stuff. Oh, damn it. I want to get into, how are you enjoying the space dust?
That's really nice.
Yeah, I like it. I'm fond of it. I want to reload, take a quick break here, and then get more into like the philosophical side of working at JPL. I want to know more about the world there as well, and all of your thoughts on that. I feel like we're getting to know each other a little bit. Each thing you drop is more fast. Oh man, I lived in France for a year. I lived in Paris. What? It's pretty. So
then I came back and got a PhD from Caltech. Just to finish it off.
Man, just as an aside.
I just didn't want a job. I wanted to go to school for a long time, which I did.
Yeah, and I feel like the trajectory you took was both circuitous and fortunate and perfect. Just really...
I really wouldn't change anything about it. I got really fortunate with what was offered to me. I did my best to take advantage of it and just had a lot of fun.
And now you've ended up in the space cave.
Exactly.
It's all a full circle. All right. Well, cool. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back with more Jason Rabinovich and maybe a different IPA. We'll see. Maybe we'll continue with this. We'll see. Okay. So stick around for part two. It gets more into some of the philosophical side of things and further into his life and knowledge and what excites him. And I just really enjoy chatting with him. That beer is pretty good too. If you haven't had anything from Elysium, check it out. We have a different type next week, and I'll let you know what that is when I chat more with Jason. So hope you enjoyed that. I thought it was fascinating. Let's see. The standard stuff. iTunes helps. Thanks to those of you who've sent along music and beer recommendations. I appreciate that. I'll get to them down the road. And if you have anyone that's in a band that's trying to get their music out there, send them my way. Perhaps we'll play it on the show. If you'd like to chat, Twitter @space_cave. Perhaps we will chat voice to voice. And if not, if you want to just stay out there in the distance and us having this sort of tether between us, that is totally agreeable. I'm with you on that. I'd like to give a little shout out to Phil, who took a photograph of him with the beer of last week in front of his computer, sitting down and really getting involved in the space cave. I thought that was cool. So I try to tweet like the Friday or so before what beer we're going to be having. So if you have time over the weekend and want to race out and grab some, you can, and then join in and drink the same beer that we are having. All right, I think that's it for me. I mentioned the Boise thing, Liquid Laughs, Treefort Festival, March 24th through the 28th. Hope to see you there. The audio from One Headed Beast will be coming out as a digital release soon, so you can own just the audio if you'd like to transport it with you. And speaking of noises and sounds and music that go in your ears, Rob Crow did our theme song for this show. It's someone tweeted the other day that they get goosebumps every time they hear it, and I don't disagree. I think it's a nice, warming introduction into the show, and thanks to Dan also for putting the show together. This show is brought to you by those two guys mostly, and Rob is finishing up the tour for his solo album, You're Doomed, Be Nice, and this next song is one from that. I think you can go see them there on the West Coast all this week, finishing up, so check out their website, or just look online, or I'll post a link at thespacecave.com, and go see them. Go support them. The new stuff's really fantastic. The band's good. Here is Red Alone from Rob Crow's Gloomy Place. Thanks for stopping by the Space Cave.